Well, we're in the period of the United Kingdom. We've been talking about the book of 1 Samuel, where this period begins. Samuel has been sort of rejected by the people. They've asked for a king, and he had great difficulty with that because of the problems that he knew would be true, and he warned them of the problems. Saul became king, began as a very good person. It looked like he was going to be the ideal king for Israel, but things went sour after that. David came on the scene, became a national hero, you might say, being the deliverer of the people from the threat, the scourge of a man who seemed to be invincible. The people praised him. This didn't set well with Saul. And so Saul began to a quest to get David out of the way. He saw him as a threat to his kingdom. Of course, God had said that the kingdom would be taken away from Saul because of misdeeds that he had done on at least two different occasions. And now he continues to compound the problem by chasing David all over the place. In our last a few minutes of our study yesterday, or this past week rather, we were talking about the David as after the massacre of the priests in the city of Nob, the city of priests. Abiathar escaped and came to David. Then David was told that the city of Keilah was being attacked by the Philistines, which was their want to do. And David, with this band of men that had assembled with him after he escaped from the presence of Saul, it began as a group of about 400 and eventually grew up to a group of around 600. And they delivered the city of Keilah from the Philistines. And not only delivered them from the Philistines, but took a lot of their possessions, their livestock, and perhaps enriched the city of Keilah. They should have been grateful for it. David was there in that little city, and in the vicinity of that little city, a walled city. Saul saw this as an opportunity to trap David. David had been going throughout the rough wilderness country of Judah, hiding in caves and forests and wilderness territory of one kind or another, rocks. And now he's in this place where it looks like Saul has got him, and somehow he feels that God is on his side. In spite of all the evidence, all the things that have taken place that should have shown Saul that God was not for him, that God was against him, that God was going to take the kingdom away from him. Nevertheless, he seems to think that somehow or other this is God has delivered him into my hand. He says in chapter 23 and verse 7, 1 Samuel, God has delivered him into my hands. Somehow or other he holds on to this delusion that God is on his side, though he knows better. People are able to deceive themselves. A lot of times in religious matters, people deceive themselves into believing they're a prophet or that God has spoken to them or something of that kind. And Saul seems to be of that mind. And so David seems to be in a rather difficult position. Saul may have him trapped, but we understand that God is on David's side. David learned of the plot against him, that Saul was going to try to trap him there in Keilah, and he asked Abiathar, the priest, to bring him to come with the ephod and to ask of God what was about to take place and what to do and things of that type. He asked the question, will Saul come down and try to trap me, try to capture me, try to kill me? And the Lord answered, he will come down. And he said, will the people of Keilah deliver me to Saul? And the answer was in the affirmative. In spite of all the good that that David had done for them. Or the city of Keilah would deliver him into the hand of Saul. So David did as he always did. When a threat came, he just went somewhere else. God was delivering him from every effort that Saul put forth. But David nevertheless had to do his part, and that being get away from the scene of the danger. And this is something that people did, even in New Testament times. Jesus sometimes would go over across the Jordan to the other side to get away from the Jews that were trying to kill him. He could call for 12 legions of angels to deliver him, even from the cross. But he didn't choose to do that. He just chose to go elsewhere at various times. And so David chose this avenue of escape. And so when he escaped from Keilah, Saul dropped that pursuit. David stayed in the strongholds of the wilderness, and he remained in the mountains, the wilderness of Ziph. He's down there in Ziph at this time. Kind of get our bearings where Ziph is located. There, nope, that's Ziklag. Ziph, right there. Here's Gibeah, here's Jerusalem, here's Ziph. So in the wilderness of Ziph, he's escaped to that place. And as you notice, it's called a wilderness in a forest, it says, where you can have a lot of cover, a lot of places to hide. And while he was... And it is interesting, verse 14, it says that even though he dropped that pursuit and that effort to trap him in the city of Keilah and to have the people of that city deliver David to him, he sought him every day, but God did not deliver him into his hand. That's the key element in the whole thing. God did not deliver him into Saul's hand, meaning that God delivered him from Saul's hand. But then he went to the wilderness of Ziph in the forest. Jonathan came to Saul. Jonathan, Saul's son, came to David. I keep getting these names backward, my mouth gets to running faster than my brain sometimes. But anyway, Saul's son Jonathan came to David. He went to David in the woods, and he strengthened his hand in God. That's an interesting thing. He didn't just go up to him and say, tell him to look into his inner strength. He didn't go to him and say, "You can do it. You can beat this situation. You're stronger than, you're wiser than my father, so you can be." He strengthened his hand in God. It's like the Apostle Paul said when he was, he said, "I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me." The element of the presence and the intervention of Christ seemed to be uppermost in Paul's mind and in Jonathan's mind. Any person who recognizes that we are so dependent upon God never forgets about that and always brings it. It's always in the forefront of his mind. I thought about this. A passage in the book of Ruth in chapter 2 and verse 4. I've read this a number of times. Each time I read it, it really doesn't have anything to do with deliverance or divine intervention or anything like that. But during the period of the book of Ruth, which was during the period of the judges, at the time the judges ruled, Boaz had a plantation, a farm. He had reapers, and they reaped the crops. They mowed the wheat, gathered it into the barn, and so forth. And Boaz went to town on one occasion. He came back, and I've just always been impressed. It doesn't make a big deal about this, but as he came to the reapers, the way that he approached them as he came back from the city, he says, "The Lord be with you." And they answered him, "The Lord bless you." They were out there reaping wheat or whatever kind of grain it was. And it wasn't a Bible study. it wasn't a time when they got into their Sunday best and came together for a worship service. They were out there in the field. Everybody's hot and sweaty. And they were intent upon reaping the crop. But there was something that they never forgot, that the Lord is present and that we need to be aware of Him. And so Boaz says to them, "The Lord bless you." And they said, "The Lord be with you." Or maybe vice versa. Just the fact that they were always conscious of the Lord's presence and His intervention in the affairs of life. And it would seem to me, and this, as I said, was during the period of the judges, a period in which every man did that which was right in his own eyes, and they were constantly in a cycle of doing evil and then being oppressed and then being delivered and then a period of calm and peace and so forth, and then they'd do evil and then the cycle would begin again. It was not a period when people in general were very conscious of God. But enough about that. It's just the fact that throughout history, there's always been this element of, and this group of people, this remnant of people that have not lived like the people around them. And here in this period of time when so many, Saul was not seemingly not concerned about God except when it fit his purpose, or when he thought God was on his side, doing things in the way that he would have them done, then he was conscious of God. He did God's will as long as it suited him. But Jonathan and David were of a kindred spirit. Both of them were concerned about God. And so Jonathan strengthened his hand in God. And he said, "Do not fear, for the hand of my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you." Even my father Saul knows this. He was aware that David would eventually be king. It had never been stated publicly. He was anointed in a very private ceremony, but the language that God had used, or that Samuel had used in speaking of what God would do, he would take the kingdom away and give it to his neighbor that was a better person than him. Who would fit that description better than David? And so everyone seemed to be aware that David was in line to be king. And Saul knew it, even though he continued to hold to that little thread of hope that perhaps something, he could work hard enough, he could be devious enough that he could thwart the will of God. But another thing that Jonathan said, "I will be next to you." It would have been a great thing if he had just stayed there, wouldn't it? But I thought about, why did he not stay with David? He said, "I'll be next to you in your kingdom." We know that eventually Jonathan was with his father when his father was killed in battle. His father was killed in battle because of his evil deeds. Jonathan was an innocent victim of it, along with his two brothers. They were innocent victims of Saul's folly. And thus Jonathan didn't have the opportunity of being with David when he when David eventually became king. And so they they did not just make a covenant, they renewed the covenant they already had. This is the second time that it had been renewed. They were, as I said, of a kindred spirit. They were concerned about God and His will. And so they renewed this covenant between them. They'd already talked about what David would do for his descendants after he had departed this life. And so Jonathan, I guess because he had family back home and because of his loyalty to his father in spite of his evil deeds, he returned home, and that's, as far as we know, the last time that they were together. So then as David was down there in Ziph, in the wilderness of Ziph, the Ziphites went to Gibeah. They went up there and made up an offer. What was the offer they made to Saul? Okay. They borrowed a page out of the book of the people of the little city that we talked about earlier, Keilah. They went up there and offered to turn David over to Saul. They wanted to come down and we'll do our part. You come on down, you bring your army down here. He's down there close to us. We know where he is. And you bring your army down and we'll turn him over to you. And another one of those rather strange statements coming out of the mouth of Saul. Blessed are you of the Lord, for you have compassion on me. We could talk for a good while about that. I think of a lot of things I'd like to say about that. First of all, how foolish it is of him to invoke the name of God in a case like this when he was doing something that was totally out of harmony with the will of God. He was being just about as evil as any person could possibly be in trying to destroy the person that God had put in place to be his successor. And yet he says, blessed are you of the Lord. And the Lord is just so proud of you for doing this. And he said, for you have compassion on me. Compassion? What had been done to him? As had been said by many people. Jonathan had mentioned it to Saul. Ahimelech, the priest, had mentioned to Saul how honorable David was, how he had done nothing to deserve this ill treatment. And this idea that David was lying in wait for him is just utter foolishness. He was constantly running from him. And it kind of reminds me of a person I worked for a number of years. He was pretty good at self-deception. He'd tell, we'd have a little meeting of the employees, and he'd talk about that. He'd say, and y'all know I work harder than work longer hours than any of you. And of course, all of us stood there and thinking. And finally, somebody said one time when the big man wasn't around, when does he do all this work? We don't see it. We come in, we work overtime. We come in on Saturday or something like that, and he's nowhere around. He spends half his time away from the business somewhere else. But he could say, I work longer hours than any of you. But he knew that it was not so, and yet he thought he could make us believe it because he said it. But our eyes showed us that this was not the case. People have the ability to deceive themselves. I think we've already stated that. People have done that in religion. Saul had this ability to deceive himself. He's made. Yes?
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's okay.
He said that God has compassion on them. There's a good chance that what they really have here is pure. And they see the ruthlessness with which treated the priests there. And, for them, however, this was a calculated risk. If they had had the same heart that Saul had, when he did, ascend to the throne, of course, mm-hmm. He could come back. He would have known about this betrayal. He could have done the same thing Saul did.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little more
difficult,
a lot more
difficult. Yeah. Could very well be. I've tried to think of what their motivation would be for turning David over to Saul, and it could be that they were just afraid of him. And, there were various things that they might have, various reasons why they might have wanted to be in the good standing with Saul. But anyway, they were made this offer to turn him over to David, over to Saul, and Saul wanted them to look and to find his hideouts, find the places where he'd hide. And it's always been interesting to me that he uses the term, for I am told he's very crafty. There's a rumor going around that David is very crafty. Well, of course, we understand that it's not just craftiness on the part of David that's getting him away from Saul. But it's interesting that he would say, I'm told that he is very crafty, like he hadn't seen it for himself, that everywhere he went, he'd think, I've got him this time. He'd go there. David was somewhere else. Again, maybe he's living in that dream world. I've just been told this. I don't know it for sure, but anyway, I'm told that he's very crafty. So he wants them to look, find where he's hiding. I'll go to him. I'll come on down and I'll even go throughout all the clans, it says in this version, all the clans of Judah. And literally, if you have a center column reference like this Bible, what is the clans, what's that, what is the literal translation of that? You want to know? All the thousands of Judah. He's going to check every person. He's not going to leave one stone unturned. He is so determined to get this fellow who is lying in wait for him, as it is at this day. That's such a strange thing that he is making such a tremendous effort. He's looking for the needle in the haystack to get this person who is such a threat to him, who is an honorable man, has never done anything to him, and has asked the question, "What have I done?" But anyway, he's going to look through all the clans, all the thousands of Judah. And so he went to Ziph and to the wilderness there where David had gone for refuge at this time. But what did David do? David heard about it. What did he do? Stay around to see what would happen? Went to the wilderness of Maon in the plain of the south of Jeshimon. Jeshimon. That's another one of those names that we're not all that familiar with, but they knew about it then. I guess it was familiar to them. And when Saul went down, David went to the rock and stayed in the wilderness of Maon. There are a lot of rocks. There are a lot of places where people can hide, places where they can, like the Edomites, trusted in their mountain, Mount Seir. It was up in the rocks. They had a vantage point where they could fend off any force, even a superior force that came against them. And so David sought places like that in the wilderness of Maon, this rock. That will come into play in a little bit. And there was this mountain, and David was on one side of the mountain, and Saul and his men were on the other side. But Saul was not content to leave things like that way. What did he do? What did Saul do when they were on opposite sides of a mountain? Did he just lay siege to him, or did he take some other action? Well, it says he encircled. They were encircling David. As the old song says, he was coming around the mountain seeking for David. He wasn't content to stay right there. He came on around. But something intervened. Remember that God did not deliver David into the hands of Saul. And I'm not going to say that word because it's too hard to say. The antithesis of that is that God was delivering him from the hand of Saul. I did say it, didn't I? But anyway, a messenger came to Saul, told him, "Hurry and come, for the Philistines have invaded the land." So something else has come up. Not just something that had come up. I think it's evident that God is using even the Philistines on this occasion to pull Saul away from David. Once again, as David is in some danger, they're encircling him, they're about to surround him, the Philistines come into the land. And like God used other heathen nations like the Assyrians and the Babylonians, the Philistines invaded the land. That was just sort of their nature. They were always finding a place where they go and invade and attack and pilfer, and that's kind of how they made their living, I gather. And anyway, Saul had to return from pursuing David, and so this rock that is spoken of back there in verse 25, I guess it's the same rock anyway. Last we knew that where David was in a rock became known as what? What did it become known as? Verse 28, last line. Okay, the Rock of Escape. The Rock of Escape is what it became known as. And so David went from there and dwelt in the strongholds in En Gedi. He's always finding a place that would be referred to as a stronghold, a place where he could be safe, a place where, and that in Gedi is over here. See, he was over here in Ziph, went to Maon, and now he's over here next to the Dead Sea. It's about halfway of the length of the Dead Sea on the shore, or just close to the shore at En Gedi. Does anyone know what that word, that prefix "en" denotes? Okay, it seems like a lot of folks know that one. It's a spring. We know of other places that had similar names, indicating that the presence of a spring in that particular location. On up to the north, later on, in just a few chapters, we'll be studying about a place called what? Where a woman, an old woman who is known as a medium, or passed herself off as a medium or a witch. She lived in a place called what? Endor. So that seems to be a place where a spring was. There was another place called Enrogel. And so it's a place where a spring was located. Well, it happened that this pursuit of the Philistines didn't last particularly long, didn't become a major battle. But it was a diversion for Saul or for David, depending on how you look at it. It was an opportunity for David to get away from Saul. He went over to the strongholds of En-Gedi and along the coast of the Dead Sea. It just keeps dropping on down. A lot of caves around there, good places to hide scrolls along the Dead Sea. Somebody did use that that means of hiding some scrolls or putting some in there to preserve them or something. They were found sometime in the middle 1940s, and are still around. People have been able to look at them. But anyway, it was in that area where a lot of caves are located. And so David went there to the wilderness of En-Gedi. Well, Saul took 3,000 chosen men of all Israel. We'll talk about that for a little while. He was so determined. He chose men from all over Israel. He didn't just take anybody. He wanted the strongest, wisest, most military-oriented people that he could get. Chosen men of all Israel. And went to seek David and his men, the Rock of the Wild Goats. And that sounds like a pretty good place to go if you want to get away from somebody. Wild goats. They're pretty sure-footed. They're able to climb up on top of rocks and up and down and over and so forth. And so it's a pretty good place to go have a secure place. The rocks of the wild goats. And Saul came to that area with his 3,000 chosen men of all Israel against this band of 600 ragtag, misfits, discontented people, people in debt, people that were not particularly skilled as military people, but God had used them to fend off the army of the Philistines against that little city that we were talking about a while ago, and not only that, but take their livestock. It seems like a mismatch again, but some fortuitous event takes place. David and his men were in one of the caves. It just happened that as Saul was there among this group of 3,000 chosen men of all Israel, that he had a reason to seek some privacy. He didn't seem to want to attend to his needs in the presence of these 3,000 men, so he went into a cave. The term "attend to his needs," it also refers to it in the King James as "cover his feet." So it's one of those things that occurred. And so he went into the cave to attend to his needs. David and his men were in the recesses of the cave. They were able to hide in there. Of course, it's dark. Couldn't see them even if you if they were in plain view. And Saul, as he was, quote, attending to his needs, David, his men saw what was taking place. I guess they saw Saul coming in from the entrance, the light shining in. This is it. And they even kind of made up a little scenario here. Said, this is the day of which the Lord said to you. The Lord said that there's going to come a time when you're going to be able to have the drop on Saul. And you're going to be... Nothing like that ever happened. They were pretty good at dreaming things up themselves, weren't they? Behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand. You may do to him as seems good to you. Just do to him whatever you want to do. You want to get rid of him. You want to stop this foolishness of being chased all over the place. Now is your chance. And God has said that he's going to give you that chance. And now nothing like that ever happened. Well, I guess David was, he didn't like being chased all over. And he saw this as, I guess for the moment, he saw this as an opportunity at least to make a point with Saul. What did he do? Okay. Sneaked up behind him somewhere or other. And I guess Saul was otherwise occupied, and so he couldn't see around him. So he, somehow or other, I've always found it to be very difficult. It would seem to be very difficult in a place like that with the acoustics, that any sound made, even the slightest rustling, would be heard, would it not? But anyway, he was able to get up there and cut off the corner of his robe. Well, but after he did, his conscience got to bothering him and said, I've done something very disrespectful. It seems to be the thought. I've stretched out my hand against the Lord's anointed, and I should not have done this. We need to think about people in authority and the way that we speak of them, and the way that we conduct ourselves in regard to them. So, the Apostle Paul in Acts 23, not talking about the king, not talking about the emperor, just talking about the high priest. He made a statement to him that was kind of sharp, and someone pointed out, you're talking to the high priest. He said, I wasn't aware I was talking to the high priest, for it is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people. We need to take that very seriously. As we talk about Obama, or we talk about Bush, or we talk about the governor, or even the local mayor, we need to be very careful that we don't speak in a way that, as Paul would say it, speaking evil of him. David was very concerned about what he had done. David restrained his servants. He didn't allow them to strike Saul down. That was a golden opportunity. If you're going to stop this thing, this is the place to do it. Well, Saul got through with what he was doing there, and so he went out of the cave and went on his way. After he had gotten a safe distance away, David left the cave and called out after it. He was out in a place where, you know, it was sort of like a valley there, and I guess the acoustics were pretty good. And so even though he was probably far enough away that it was a safe distance, he was still able to make himself heard. He called out to Saul, and he said, "My lord the king." He still, he didn't holler, "Hey, you." He didn't holler, "Hey, you big whatever." He saw it's "My lord the king." He's still referring to him in a way that shows respect. And so Saul looked back, and what did David do then? Shake his fist at him? Okay. He stooped down, put his face to the earth. He was showing respect, and it wasn't something he was doing in a mocking way. He was sincere. That's one thing about David. He was always sincere. Whatever he did, he did it in dead earnest. And he bowed his face to the earth. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, indeed, David seeks you your harm?" Saul had all those people that were willing to feed his ego and to feed his desire for holding on to his throne. And they were always telling him all these false things and making him believe it because he kind of wanted to anyway. He said, "Why are you listening to these people that say, David's trying to get you. He's lying in wait for you. He had the priest inquire of God against you? All these things that that people have made up and told Saul. And he points out the fact that something that should be evident to anybody that knows about God and knows about things that are right. Look, this day your eyes have seen that the Lord has delivered you into my hand in the cave. And someone urged me to kill you. He didn't know about that particularly. But he's pointing out the fact that the Lord has delivered you. You can see what has happened. The Lord has delivered you into my hands. And someone wanted me to kill you, but my eyes spared you. I wouldn't do that because I knew that wasn't right. I will not stretch out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. He could be the most wicked, evil person on the face of the earth. And yet the fact that back there when Samuel took the vial of oil and poured it on Saul's head, he was not doing just some empty ceremony dreamed up by a bunch of men. This was what God wanted him to do. He anointed Saul as the king. And moreover, my father, notice he's continuing to speak in a respectful way. My father, he refers to. He shows them the corner of the robe. See this piece of material here that I cut off of your robe? That knife that I used to cut off the corner of your robe, I could just as easily have used it and plunged it into your back or your wherever, and you would be dead right now. That would make a person think, wouldn't it? Why would he allow Saul to get away? If he was lying in wait for him, then this would be the time to do it. See, he didn't go into a big explanation about the fact that he had done wrong in his own eyes, and perhaps, in fact, had done wrong by cutting off the corner of his robe. But he said, I've cut off the corner of your robe, and here it is. Saul had walked along with the corner of his robe missing and hadn't noticed it. But now he's saying, look, and I guess Saul perhaps looked down and saw that it was gone. There's neither evil nor rebellion in me, yet you hunt my life to take it. The Lord judge between you and me. Let the Lord avenge me on you. David didn't give any reason for Saul to think that he was going to get away. The Lord is going to take care of this. You're going to suffer for this, but it's not going to be at my hand. And he points out an old proverb that the ancients had used. Wickedness proceeds from the wicked. That's just the way it is. People that are wicked, they're going to do wickedly. But my hands shall not be against you. He's saying, I'm not that wicked person. Wicked people will do wickedly, but not me. He's not bragging on himself. He's just stating a fact. Job said, I've done no sin. I'm not deserving of what is being done to me. And David, likewise, saying, I've done nothing to deserve what you're doing to me. But the Lord will take care of it. And he just quoted a proverb from someone who was not inspired. Paul did this in the New Testament. They quoted from a prophet of the Cretans. He quoted from a poet of the people in Athens. People sometimes use quotations from commentators or even poets today. Nothing wrong with that as long as we don't attach inspiration to them. But anyway, and after whom has the king of Israel come out? He's talking about you're the king of Israel. You have all this power, this authority. You've come out against someone that makes no more difference than a dead dog. You take the worst dog on the face of the earth that could tear you to pieces if he's alive, but if he's dead, you can walk up to him and goose him or whatever you wanted to do, and he couldn't do a thing to you. Or a flea. What can a flea do? You just see him there and you smack him and he's gone. That's what David says I'm like. And you're the king of Israel. And so, therefore the Lord judge between you and me and see and plead my case and deliver me out of your hand. So when David had finished speaking these words to Saul, he said, Saul began to answer him, Is this your voice, my son David? He's changed his what he calls David. He's been you son of Jesse. when he kind of had contempt for somebody, he'd refer to them as the son of whoever their father was. Didn't call them by name. Ahimelech was the son of Ahitub, you know. So now he's my son, David. He's more than just David. He's my son, David. Now, lifted up his voice and wept. For a time it seems that there's some contrition, even in this ambitious, hard-hearted person, Saul. He says, you're more righteous than me and than I, and that you have rewarded me with good when I have rewarded you with evil. He, as Brother Tonis Davis used to say, shell down the corn. He said, you did good and I did evil. Sounds like he's turning his life around. The Lord delivered me into your hands. You didn't kill me. For, he says, if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? It's just not the way it's done. But you're not that wicked man. You're not just an ordinary man who would find his enemy and kill him. Well, didn't get through with everything that we're going to talk about. Maybe we can get those last couple of verses in. Psalm 54 and 57 are written in connection with these things that we just talked about in this lesson today.